in a series on stewardship. I don't know, you may not have heard the either or both of the previous, but have a look on the website. I think they're recorded. If they're not, then you can go to the London website and something very similar you'll be able to find on there. Oh no, not again. Churches, money, always wanting money. Preachers, always talking about money. There must be other things to talk about. And there are. But money is something that we do need to talk about. And if you think it's a bit much in terms of proportion, then maybe just have a look. And I know a few figures, but I've not verified them by my own study. What proportion of Jesus' parables concerned possessions or wealth? Maybe have a think and maybe have a guess and then go away and do some research. There's a few figures I've got in my mind. But if over the course of a year then the proportion of the sermons is greater than that, then maybe someone who echoed similar sentiments to those I just parodied would have a case. I just know it was a lot. 2 weeks ago we considered giving to God. How do you bless the blesser? How do you give something to the person who has everything? Is that possible? And then we looked primarily at the biblical principle of tithing, which is to give a tenth of all that you receive. And today we're going to consider giving to God, part two, which is giving to God's people. So giving to God, part one, is giving to God. And giving to God, part two, is giving to God, bracket, apostrophe S, where apostrophe is the wrong way around, God's people. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, he says this, "Now about the collection for God's people." The collection for God's people. "On the first day of every week, each of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made." Collecting, receiving, giving for God's people is biblical. And we're going to look at what does that mean? Who are included in God's people? Does it exclude those who are not God's people? Last time I asked one of the children looked at my notes and they saw, I think I had the question, why do we give to God? And so I put the question to them. And the answer they gave was so that we're not greedy and to show that we love him. Why do we give to God? To show that we're not greedy. Greed is idolatry, Paul tells us. And to show that we love him. So this week, I asked one of the children, why do we give to God's people? And this was the answer. So that it can be used in a good way to do something like the creche where we give money. That's outside of Stellenbosch in South Africa. And teach them about God. We give money to God's people so that it could be used in a good way to do something like the creche where we give money and teach them about God. At home, I forgot to bring it with me. There's a jar that we have in which we put coins of a certain denomination, usually up to a certain denomination, and you might find a note in there when we've raided it for something else and then we've had to do an IOU. But in that jar, it's money that goes to support this creche that Procorus have in South Africa. British pennies go quite a long way. Never despise a penny. They go quite a long way. And I remember being at Sunday school in the 70s and the 80s in the north of England. And we had two collection receptacles. We had a box, a wooden box, which was for the church. And then we had a glass jar, which was for a family who had two children, an Irish woman and a Nigerian man, and their two children who were working, coordinating a number of churches in the north of Nigeria. So we were taught, I was taught, even as a 3, 4, and 5-year-old, that we give to the church, which is tithing. Now, we didn't have our own incomes in those times. I may have tithed on my pocket money, I can't remember. I don't think I did. I remember it went, my pocket money went from 15 pence to 30 pence. And I was really pleased because it meant I could now buy a bag of chips. Chips in those days were 30 pence. I remember even when they were a bit less. But I thought, with my pocket money, I can buy a meal. I felt quite grown up. But I don't think I tithe because if I tithed, then I wouldn't have been able to buy my bag of chips. And we're teaching our children that if their grandparents give them a pound, they can't go to Poundland because 10 pence is taken, not away, but given. 10 pence is reserved. So they have to wait for another grandparent to give another pound and then they can go to Poundland. But I was blessed to be taught almsgiving. A-L-M-S, giving. Almsgiving. Do you know the phrase? Okay, so the Bible talks about three types of giving. Tithing, a tenth of everything that comes in. Offerings, which is anything on top of that for general use through the church. And then the third is almsgiving. And alms, I didn't know this. We use it as a phrase, but what's its derivation? I wonder if any of you have asked that question. It comes from the word to give mercy. That's what we're doing. Now, I'm still processing that a bit, but that's, maybe just have a think. What does that mean? When you give something to someone who's in need, you're showing them mercy. So mercy, what is mercy? We were singing about mercy earlier with our DJs. Mercy is not receiving what we deserve. Now you might think, oh, how does that work? If I'm giving something, how is it not receiving? Well, when we give an alms, it's so that somebody has food and doesn't die, or has clothes and doesn't get ill. So the mercy is that they don't get that illness, that they don't die of starvation, because somebody who's one of God's people has shown them mercy. That's alms. Have a question for you. What is the most valuable gift you've given? I asked a while ago, what's the most valuable gift you've received? What's the most valuable gift you've given? Have a think. You could think as wide or as narrow as you wish. Would you give someone your last piece of chocolate? I had a friend at school who couldn't be bothered to fish in the bottom of the crisp packets for the crumbs. He just couldn't be bothered. And he couldn't be bothered to find a bin. So he would always, invariably, do you want mine? And I would accept. Because the value to me was greater than the value to him. He couldn't be bothered to get his fingers greasy. He couldn't be bothered to go and find a bin. Do you want these? So he won, because he didn't have to get dirty or find a bin. I won because I got a few crisps. The value to me, because of his laziness, the value to me was greater than the value to him. What's the most valuable gift that you've given? What's the most valuable gift you've given? And we're just going to look for a few minutes, not for very long. What do we give? Okay, it's Valentine's Day, so you might have some clues. What do we give? We'll come on to that. We'll come on to that. What do we give? How do we give? To whom do we give? And then, how much do we give? What do we give? How do we give? And including in the how is the how not. What do we give? How do we give? And therefore, by extension, by correlation, by correspondence, how do we not give? To whom do we give? And how much do we give? Then we're going to conclude. So it was Valentine's yesterday, and I wonder if you received or you gave. Love can be communicated in different ways. Keep that in your mind, and then look at these words from Luke chapter 10 to answer the question, what do we give? Jesus says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. There are two sides of one coin, loving God and loving your neighbor. So if you were worried a bit that we were going to be exclusive about giving within the family, giving to God's people, Jesus went on to explain what he meant by neighbor, who he meant by neighbor. And he told the parable of the Good Samaritan. The one who isn't your necessarily immediate neighbor, that's perhaps, I mean, the world today means we have neighbors all over the world. All over the world and from all over the world. But Jesus was saying, not the person you might choose, but everyone, the other person, the person from the other group. But loving the Lord your God and loving your neighbor are two sides of one coin. You can't separate them. Last night, one of the things we learned at the event was that that's God's purpose for marriage, male and female, two sides of one coin. Devaluing one devalues the other. Honoring one gives honor to the other. What do we give? We give love. God says, love me. Jesus says, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Two of them going together. John Chapman in his book talks of the different languages of love, and he says there are different dialects, but across the world, according to his study, and it fits, love is communicated in one of five ways. And one might communicate it more than others. Those five ways being gifts, touch, service, time, and words. Gifts, touch, service, time, and words. Each one will have a primary language, maybe a secondary one as well. What's God's love language? I've asked it before, but what's God's love language? Now, God accepts all of those. He accepts gifts. When Jesus was on earth, he accepted touch. We looked a while ago at the woman who broke open the alabaster jar, the single-use perfume representing a whole inheritance or a whole life's earning. He accepted her touch when she wiped his feet with her hair. He accepts acts of service. She was also given acts of service. He accepts time. He used to spend time with people. And he accepted words. But God's primary love language is none of those five. God's primary love language is, according to John 14:15, obedience. Obedience. Jesus said, if you love me, has anyone ever said that to you? If you love me, maybe a child has said it to you, maybe a spouse or a spouse-to-be has said, if you love me, you will. And Jesus said this, if you love me, you will obey what I command. In other words, the way in which we show God our love for him is by obeying his commands. So how, if that's how we love God, if that's how we love God, with all our heart and all our strength and all our soul and all our mind, how do we love our neighbor as ourselves? The first thing, we need to have a right relationship with self. I need to relate to myself in the right way. I need to love myself. Not in an egocentric me, myself, and I. Not in that way. But I need to know who I am, who God tells me I am, who God has made me to be, so that I'm able to love myself in the right way. So if we think about giving to God's people, I wonder what came to your mind. But if we're one of God's people, then when we give to God's people, we're giving to ourselves. If something goes into the family coffer, every member of that family is blessed. I remember I used to commute with Gibby and Joe, who used to work for the church before they went to work for Live Village. Live at Live Village. And we'd sometimes be sitting in the London traffic, and give you would say, we're not stuck in traffic, we are traffic. We're part of that traffic. And it works in a negative way, but it also works in a positive way. If we give to God's people, and I'm one of God's people, then I'm blessed. So don't think I'm going to give to God's people in London, or I'm going to give to God's people in South Africa, or I'm going to give to God's people in Malawi, or I'm going to give to God's people in India. Think I'm going to give to God's people, and I am one of God's people. I may have different needs. As I look around, I look at our clothes. We have needs that are less than the majority of God's people. But we are one of God's people. So if somebody says give, and it's a command, imagine this. The command is give. It's an imperative, it's an instruction, give. What question comes to your mind? What question comes to your mind? I think some of you, to whom? To whom? And maybe others of you will think this, how much? And we're going to look at both of those. We're relational beings. Okay? We're not human doings. We're relational beings, human beings. So first, we're going to look at how to give. Because the how is important. The how is important. It's important to God. It's important to people. Imagine Valentine's Day, I throw some flowers on the table. There you go. It doesn't really work. Let's say even worse, I eat half a chocolate bar. There you go. How we give is important. It's important to people and it's important to God. How not to give. First we're going to look at how to give, how not to give, included in that. Then to whom, and then how much. Now this verse of scripture is famous. I put a question. What type of giver is loved by God? I imagine you'll know. Did I give you the reference? No. Anyone know the reference? When I was at medical school, the doctors and teachers would ask us something and we'd kind of just... Cheerful giver. 2 Corinthians, which chapter? Verses 7, 9, 7. 2 Corinthians 9, 7. Each one should give what he's decided in his heart to give. That's how we give. I'm going to come back to that. For God loves a cheerful giver. And then how not to give... Not reluctantly or under compulsion. So starting with how not to give, there should be no compulsion. So don't think I'm preaching a sermon and in my mind I've got some kind of compulsion that I'm trying to put upon you to tell you what to give. If you're compelled in that kind of way, reluctant compulsion, then maybe just pause. Now, we looked a couple of weeks ago. If we wait for the joy before we give, some of us will never give. If we wait for the cheer before we give, some of us would give, maybe all the time, maybe even irresponsibly, but some of us would never give if we wait for the cheer. So we give, and in giving comes the cheer. We looked at David in the Old Testament, 1 Chronicles 29, if you want to look it up. He explains what he gave, the gold and the silver, from what was amassed for the temple. And then he goes on and he says what he gives of his own wealth. And it tells us that he was joyful and that the people were joyful. Okay? Paul says, each one should give what he, she has decided in his heart. Not in the head. Decided in the heart. Giving that pleases God doesn't always make sense. You could say it often doesn't make sense. When the woman broke the jar, it didn't make sense and the disciples didn't like it. They didn't like it. It was a lot of money. They said this money could have been used for the poor. And that's why the tithing comes, the sermon on tithing came before the sermon on almsgiving and offerings. First we give to God. We're going to look at that in a moment. So we give with our hearts. We give what we've decided to give in our hearts, not in our heads. Because some of us will find that hard. If I do these sums, if I work out that I cannot buy a bag of chips if I give a tenth of this 30 pence, then maybe I won't do it. If I cannot buy a house if I give to someone who doesn't have a house, then maybe some of us won't do it. So Paul says, each one should give as they've decided in their hearts, not reluctantly, not under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. One person told me after one of the earlier sermons in this series that they had broken their glasses in the middle of the night. I thought it was just me who did that. They also have children, and I think children and glasses don't always go together too well. They'd broken their glasses in the middle of the night. The hassle, they have to either buy a new pair, the expense of buying a new pair, or the hassle of getting this pair repaired. And then what do you do in the meantime? So they took it to a technician near to their work. And first of all, the technician said, oh, give me a few hours. Now, the person in his mind had a few days in mind. I've got to come up with another plan for a few days. It's great, just a few hours. I can cope with that. I can wear my wobbly glasses for a few hours. And then they went back to the technician after their work, after a few hours, with their money in their pocket. And the technician said, it's okay, no charge. So they have money in their pocket, and they're going home after a day at work. And this person saw somebody begging for money. And they had it in their heart to give. They didn't give. And would it have been wise to give? I'm going to give an example of a way in which you can give in a wise way. They didn't give, but the point is this. Because they'd received and had money to spare, they had the desire to give. So we looked at this. Jesus said, when he sent out the 12, freely you've received, freely give. This person understood. They'd received something, they'd received a benefit of extra money in their pocket, and because they had received, they wanted to give. We don't give in order to receive. We don't give in order to receive. We give because we've received. Now, we do receive when we give, but that shouldn't be our motivation. And God has good ways of working out what our primary motivation is. Now, do we have mixed motives? Yes. Do we all have mixed motives? Yes. More often than we'd like to admit, thank you. Yes. I don't think Trevor had any mixed motive there. Here's a glass of water. Jesus said, if you give one in my name. Okay. But in lots of the things that we do, we have a few mixed motives. But I think God still, he works with us on that. He works with us on that. But he will find out, he'll ask the right questions, he'll set in place a set of circumstances to find out what is our primary motivation. Are we giving so that we can receive? Or are we giving because we have received? How do we give cheerfully? Don't wait for the cheer. Give and expect the cheer. Some of us are cheerily giving all the time. Spend time with people like that because it will probably rub off on you. But if you find it hard to give with cheer, spend time with somebody who does. Copy them, give. And I even ask them to impart some cheer to you. Because as we give, the cheer will come. God loves a cheerful giver. How do we give? How do we not give? To whom do we give? And Paul wrote this in Galatians. Before we go to the verse, I think they'll have a question. To whom do we give? Okay, who comes first? Here's a question. The question to help you answer the question. Who comes first and where does charity begin? Who comes first and where does charity begin? And Galatians 6 verse 10 says this. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers or the New King James will say to the household of faith. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who belong to the household of faith, to the family of believers. Where does charity begin? At home. Now, I had a problem with that when I was younger. Charity begins at home. And I had a problem with it, I think, looking back, for two reasons. The first reason is this, probably a negative connotation of charity. Charity is one of the four kinds of love. The four loves. Have a read of C.S. Lewis's book. I had a wrong view, a negative connotation of charity, but also because I saw this practiced not as charity begins at home, but as because charity begins and ends at home. So Paul says, let us do good to all people, especially. What does that especially mean? It means if you don't have enough to give to everyone you would like to give, you first give to those who are your responsibility. So it's no good if we as a family, it's a contrived example, but I hope it makes a point. If we as a family give to children in South Africa who don't have food, and we have children in our home who are starving, that would not make sense. It would be a bad witness. It would be a bad example. Now, I'm pushing it, but the point is this. If you have to choose, to whom do you give? First things first, and first people first. First people first. So if 30 people come and join us now, I haven't counted the mugs at the back. Let's say there's 20 mugs there. If 20 people come in and take up these spare seats now, after the service, what would happen? Who knows what FHB is? FHB. You might not know it as an abbreviation. Family hold back. If you have a part of a large family, you're used to lots of food on the table, but then another family join you and they're even larger, family hold back. Another way to do it is just put some extra spice in. That's another way to do it. But if 20 people come and join us now, then they will have first pick. And then even if we have to wait till later, or someone has to go to a shop and buy some more milk, we will get, but we know we just need to wait. So, on a one-off occasion, family hold back. That's how it should be. But across the course of a week or a month or a child's lifetime, it's no good me teaching at Little Gates and even teaching at church and not teaching the children God's given Sally and myself to steward. It doesn't bless God if I get my priorities wrong. So we do good as we have opportunity, according to our means, to all people and especially to those who belong to the family of faith. The family of believers, the household of faith, first we give to family. Natural family, spiritual family. We give naturally to our natural family, we give spiritually to our spiritual family. That's where we give first. We don't stop there, then we go beyond. But that's where we start. So how much do we give? Now this might be thorny, I don't know. We looked last week at Leviticus 27 verse 30. A tithe of everything belongs to the Lord. It's holy to the Lord. The entire tithe will be holy to the Lord. Sometimes as Christians, New Testament Christians, we have a cheap view of grace. We think grace means God's got it covered. Don't worry, everything's all right. Grace is actually a higher standard than the law. John Bevere points this out quite clearly. Under the Old Testament, under law, to be guilty of murder, you had to murder. Under the New Covenant, in the New Testament, under grace, to be guilty of murder, hatred makes us guilty of murder. Is that a higher or a lower standard? It's a higher standard. To be guilty of adultery under the Old Testament, Old Covenant, under law, one has to commit adultery. Under the New Covenant, in the New Testament, under grace, to be guilty of adultery, I'm guilty of adultery, as a married person, if you're not married, you cannot commit that sin, so you don't need to worry about this one. If I look lustfully, I'm guilty. It's a higher standard. And then John Bevere doesn't leave us there. Oh no, we couldn't even reach this standard. How will I reach this standard? Grace, he defines as the ability. Okay, so law here, and grace here, and my ability here. Grace is the ability to go beyond my ability. God enables me and us by grace to do what we could not do otherwise. We cannot meet the law, but God says, here's grace to meet my highest standard. So the old covenant was to give a tenth. Now, again, I've not done the sums. I've heard and read various figures. If you add up all the offerings, the tithes and the fellowship offerings and the grain offerings and lots of offerings, if you add them up, then I'm not going to give a figure, but it's a lot more than 10%. The obligatory offerings. A lot more than 10%. But let's just work with 10. If in every other way the standard of grace is higher, then will it not be in giving that the standard of grace will be higher? Now, if you can go and do it away and do your own sums, and I'm not here to press gang or coerce or twist an arm up anyone's back. I'm just saying, if every other standard is higher under grace, will it not be true under giving? Jesus spoke with two men in Luke chapters 18 and 19. And the one whose identity we know is Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus, you probably know the story. I'm not going to sing the song. But Zacchaeus, when Jesus came to his house, we read he stood up and said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half, 50%. Here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. Was his a specific case? Yes, it was a specific case. But Jesus' response to what Zacchaeus says here is to declare salvation on Zacchaeus' house. The sign of salvation for Zacchaeus was this, giving 50%, and then on top of that, if he'd wronged anyone, he specific recompense for the wrong. Okay. He gave specific recompense for the wrong, four times as much of anyone who cheated. But this, the 50% giving, plus that specific, was the sign of salvation on that house. The sign of salvation was this. That's 50%. Now, whenever there's a how question, how much, we can look for a formula. Is it 10%? Is it 50%? Is it somewhere in between? And maybe just to make the point that there perhaps isn't really a standard formula. Go one chapter back, Luke chapter 18. There's ideas about who this person was, we don't know. Rich young ruler came to Jesus, and then Jesus said to him, because he said he kept the law, Jesus said, you still lack one thing. Sell everything you have, give the money to the poor. Then he adds in, you'll have treasure in heaven. We were considering that a while back, storing up for ourselves treasure in heaven. Sell everything you have, give the money to the poor. He didn't say give everything away. He said sell everything. If you're in business, don't think it's anti-biblical. Jesus said to this guy, sell everything and then give the money. You'll have treasure in heaven and then follow me. So what does Jesus do? From the 50% of Zacchaeus, Jesus goes double or quits. There's a professor, I don't know if he's a professor, a doctor Sal used to work with, and sometimes patients would come and they'd say, I'm getting this side effect or whatever. He'd say, double or die. Now, you weren't really going to die, but he's saying this. If you want to find out whether that medication is going to do its job, let's not lower the dose, let's double the dose, and then we'll find out. So compared to Zacchaeus, Jesus says, give away everything. So he doubles the dose, double or quits. Give away, sell everything rather, and give the money. He knows which questions to ask. Jesus might ask me to give up a career, or you to give up a house, or you to give up a car. He knows what questions to ask. There's no formula here. There isn't a formula. Is it 10%? Is it 50? Is it in between? Well, here he says, sell everything. Now, would it work if we all did that? I'm not sure it would work if we all did that. And I don't know anyone else to whom Jesus said this. Although, His followers and disciples didn't really have very much, and nor did he. Is it as much as 100%? How much do we give? Is it as little as 10%? Look, all I'm going to say, I'm not going to give any formulas, it's somewhere in between 10 and 100. It's somewhere in between 10% and 100. I'm not going to give a formula, but here's two quotes, and I think they might help because they helped me. C.S. Lewis mentioned his book, The Four Loaves, earlier. He says this: I do not believe one can settle how much we ought to give. I'm afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. And then George Muller, I don't know if you know his story, lived in Bristol, set up children's homes for many children, didn't know where the money was coming from, but God always provided. And George Muller said this: God judges what we give by what we keep. God judges what we give by what we keep. Now, does that fit? Yes, because when lots of people were putting lots of money, or certain people were putting lots of money, and a widow, without, not living in a country where there was no social security, gave two mites, he said, he saw, and he said, she's given more. God judges what we give by what we keep. Might he ask some of us to give away a house? Maybe. Some of us to give up a career? Maybe. Let me say more than maybe. He probably will. You know, I'm not saying within this room, but God asks the questions that will give him the answers. That, not that he needs. He doesn't ask questions for his benefit. He already knows every answer. When God asks questions, he asks them for our benefit, so that we can find out, where is my heart? Where is my treasure? Where my treasure is, there my heart will be. Okay, so what? What's the conclusion? Paul says, just a few verses on in 2 Corinthians 9, he says this, verse 11, you'll be made rich in every way. Rich in every way, so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, through Paul and those with him, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. You'll be made rich in every way, so that you can be generous on every occasion. And through us, your generosity will result in thanksgiving to God. When we give, not only, even not primarily, but not only are needs met, when we give, God is glorified. God is glorified in our giving. Now, when we worshipped earlier, we may well have had our needs met, but more important than that is that God was glorified. And when we give, the needs of others are met, as are the needs of ourselves, because Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. But when we give, God is glorified. So the Bible school analogy I often share: when the legs do the work or the lungs do the work, Usain Bolt's head is what you see in the paper or on the screen. His legs did the work, his lungs did the work. You might get some magazines where you get men's legs. But in terms of the mainstream, it's the head that gets the glory. When we give, God is glorified. When we give, God is glorified. And not only that, God enables us to give. He says, you will be made rich. Why? So that we can have an easy life? No. We will be made rich in every way so that we can be generous on every occasion. Imagine, always generous. Always generous. Parents love it when their children take after them. When they follow the same career path. When they choose the same name, nationality. When they demonstrate a gifting in the same area. Parents love that. God is the same. What did God do? Who did God give? To whom did God give? How did God give? How did he not give? How much did he give? God gave Jesus. God gave his firstborn, his best. God gave his everything. God gave it willingly, not reluctantly, not under compulsion. All we're doing when we follow biblical practice, biblical teaching on giving, is copying God. That's all we're doing, copying God. He gave his first, he gave his best, he gave his everything, he gave his all. And he makes us rich so that we can do the same. He makes us rich so that we can always be generous. Why was David called a man after God's own heart? Have you ever thought that? Why was he called a man after God's own heart? He wrote many of the Psalms. Bernard read Psalm 16 earlier. Richard read Psalm 103. Many of those Psalms are the basis for the songs that we sing. David gave his best, not only in worship, I believe, but also in his giving. Read 1 Chronicles 29. And God said, I like that. Did David have faults? Yes. Did he mess up? Yes. Did he murder? Yes. But God saw, here is somebody who I see my heart in him. And because I see my heart in him, I know that if I give to him, he'll pass it on. I know that if I give to him, he won't block it. I know that if I give to him, he won't hoard it. I know that if I give to him, then my kingdom will come. David, a man after God's own heart. He gave his best, and God saw, he's after my heart. He has a heart that's after mine. So I asked for a volunteer to give away. I think we upped the stakes. We started at 10 and we went to 20. I need another volunteer. I can nominate Alistair. Alistair, will you give this 50? It's a coin, not a note. To Christian, please. When God gives, he often gives so that we can give on. Why are we made rich in every way? So that we can be generous on every occasion. Was it hard for Alistair to do that? I don't think so. I think he enjoyed it. Might have been harder if it was paper, 50 in paper. I don't know. I'm not going to stand here and say, you give this or you give that to God's people, because it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. What I can say is that obedience is the way to show our love for God. John 14:15. If you love me, you will obey what I command. Obedience is the way to show our love for God. So God speaks and we hear, because we're his sheep. Just a bit earlier in John 10. My sheep know me, and they know my voice. They hear my voice. So God will show us, God will tell us what he's calling us to do, what he's calling us to give, to whom, how much. He will show us. What do we need to do? Keep open our ears. Keep open our eyes, not oblivious to the needs that are even in Elmbridge, let alone in Ethiopia. Keep our eyes open, keep our ears open, and God will show us, and God will tell us. Families can fall out over money. I don't know if you ever experienced that. Families can fall out over money. But if you have a functional family, giving to the family is giving to every member of the family. And God's family functions. We're learning, we're being prepared, but God's family functions. So giving to God, part one, is giving to God. And giving to God, part two, is giving to God's people. We can't separate them. We can't give to God if we're not prepared to give to God's people. It's like trying to deface or devalue one side of a coin. The two go together like love and marriage, like a horse and carriage. We give to God and we give to God's people. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your strength and all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Please stand.